You're listening to the Punk News Podcast for the week of November 26th, 2013. Hello and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Thanks for joining us. Today on the show, we have, as always, well, I guess not as always, but as usual these days, our anchor, our guiding comedic, musical knowledge, gastronomic force, Mr. John Gentile in Philadelphia. Hi, John.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Your first time?
Not my first time, Adam, but I like to think of every time as my first time because every time I approach the Punk News Podcast, it's like approaching a virgin when it comes to conceptual discussion. You have to breach it gently. You have to cover all the bases. You have to go slowly, but assuredly.
I don't even know where I'm going with this intro. Okay, anyway, so also joining us on this show from, I believe, Brooklyn, New York, if I recall correctly, Mr. Christopher Barrett.
Hello. Hello, Punk News. Hello, everybody. I don't have anything quite as witty to say other than hello from Brooklyn.
You can just kind of hang your hat on that. Like, that's impressive to some people, I guess.
I mean, you know, I mean, you got rough trade and you got a bunch of other stuff going on in Brooklyn. Yeah, sure. Why not? Hey, from Brooklyn, what are you going to say about that?
You got the Beastie Boys, man.
Always. So much. You know, I also birthed Larry King. So think about that.
Well, okay, since I prefer being off topic to actually having a plan here. So you mentioned rough trade. What's going on for rough trade?
You know, to be honest, I'm kind of caught a little bit in the dark about that, too. I'm not going to lie about that. I am in Brooklyn, but I don't feel that the buzz comparatively around other internet spaces is as big as the actual buzz over here in Brooklyn, at least to my knowledge, because I don't live quite in a trendy neighborhood that some other people do. But it sounds like an exciting place. Obviously, you know, with the, you know, vinyl CDs, potential music space that they have going on there. So it is, I was telling John earlier, a genuinely intriguing place for me to check out. I believe they opened a few days ago.
So, yeah, to give some context to our listeners that weren't listening to the show before we started recording. Rough Trade NYC is a branch of the London shop that has been pretty important on the independent music scene since around 1976. So the store that's opening, which is opening in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, will be the biggest record store in New York City. Yeah, a lot of people are, hold on, what do I have here? 15,000 square feet.
And that's not cheap. And that part of Brooklyn, that is not cheap at all. So, I mean, they're really going for it here, you know, because I could think of a few other areas that if they want to put it in Brooklyn that they probably could have got a better deal, but they put it in a real prime location. I believe it's on North 9th Street. So that's the general hipster of Williamsburg.
Can we ask some listeners, if any of them check it out, have send us back a scene report at podcast@punknews.org. I want to know if they have like the London import records that you can only get in England and if they got used stuff too, because I don't know. I'm thinking with 15,000 square feet, you got to have used records, right? I mean,
I would hope. I mean, I love going through used record bins. So I would, you know, I would hope that they would have it, not just a bunch of stock stuff that they could order from Amazon and, you know, from over in Europe as well. So hoping it's more than that.
Yeah, there is going to be a, where is it here? It'll see that 15,000, sorry, square feet, I guess, is 15,000. Yeah. It's not strictly records. There's going to be, you know, coffee in there, and there's a 300 capacity performance space. So, oh, and a bar. So, you know, not just milk crates.
For reference, Amoeba in San Francisco, which I think is slightly smaller than Amoeba Los Angeles, which would make it the second biggest record store in America, is 24,000 feet. So 15,000 feet is pretty gigantic.
Yeah. So, yeah, let us know, people. Actually, since we're asking advice of the Punk News Podcast listenership, I'm just going to ask them for advice here. I'm trying to buy a turntable, people, and I have the I have this collection of like 1970s turntables that I've been using since I've like inherited them or stole them off various family members. I have a, I know it's not a good turntable, but it looks very nice to me. Like I have a Yamaha YPB4 that's been floating around here that does not quite work properly. But the one that actually works that I use is a dual 1225, which is from, I dated it, 1973. So I have to imagine that it's probably not giving me the optimal sound at this point in its life. So I've been looking at buying a turntable. The flip side of this is that I'm a new father, and I don't really need to spend a whole shit ton of money on a turntable since I have to spend money on, like, babies and things. So I've gotten really, really interested in the story of this U-Turn Audio Company from Boston. They're this company that they're a bunch of, like, I don't know, MIT engineers or something like that wanted to try to have, like, a pretty decent turntable, completely bare bones, but for, you know, a cheap price, but well engineered. They raised like $230,000 on Kickstarter in January to start producing these things, and they're now shipping them and selling them. So they have this Orbit turntable that's like $179 or something like that, that I am totally intrigued by. So I don't know. Does that, any of you people have it? By people, I mean not you two. I mean like the Punk News podcast listenership. I don't know. Email us, podcast@punknews.org. Curious what you guys think.
My wife was fortunate to score Techniques from the Guitar Center a few years ago for a price not too much more than that. So, I mean, it had a little cosmetic roughage, but put on a good cartridge. It's been great since. But, yeah, I followed that a little bit about that Kickstarter from U-Turn. And it does – it seems interesting. I believe it's belt-driven. So that could, I mean, as long as it's functioning properly, it could, you know, it's a good thing. But belt-driven turntables, it can have some issues because, I mean, even your General Crosley is belt-driven as well. So, that's something to keep in mind.
I see, and I was worried about that at first, and I had it in my head that I wanted one of those Audio-Technica LP120s. And I mean, they're direct drive. They're not belt driven. But I mean, the two things kind of popped into my head here. And the one is that, like, I don't really need all the crap that's on one of those Audio Technica ones. Like, I don't care about USB or anything like that. None of that has any purpose in my life. So, you know, I don't need to pay for that. But on the other hand, I figure that, like, the belt driven thing can't be completely shit or else people wouldn't be making them. So I assume if it's made well and you care for it, then you can probably get some decent, you know, at least for punk stuff that I'm listening to, sounding stuff out of it, you know?
I mean, my philosophy, at least with this, is there's just some things in life you don't generally want to skimp on too much. Because I think when I got my first tattoo, I went to a shop and they had a sign, you know, good work is not cheap and cheap work is not good. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of feel the same way about turntables. So sometimes if you kind of skimp on certain parts, might not be the best. I can't say anything negative so much from experience about the U-Turn turntable, but just in general, I don't have any general recommendations off the top of my head. But yeah, I would say if you can do research and spend a little more money, it'll definitely be worth it in the long run.
All right, podcast listeners, help me buy stuff. Email. All right, let's talk about whatever we're supposed to be talking about this week. Now, we talked about this one a little bit last week, but it bears some repeating because they've been a pretty important band in our universe. So Bottom of the Music Industry is set to play their final show on January 19th. It'll be at Warsaw in Brooklyn. So this is sticking right in our city of conversation this week. Tickets go on sale a few days ago actually, and they are now sold out. The group is offering a free live recording of the show once it's mixed to each ticket buyer. Cheap Girls is going to support them, and there are other bands that are expected to be announced soon. There's a whole statement from Jeff that's on our website that you can go find, so just look up Bomb the Music Industry on Punk News and you'll find it. Now, they announced their breakup in August of 2012, and they toured the Eastern U.S. and Australia after that announcement, which were billed as final tours. The band's last album was, of course, Vacation in 2011, which a lot of people really liked. So, you know, this is local enough to you two. You guys going to the last Bomb show?
That's a negative for me. John?
I'm a bomb. Well, I don't know if I'm a bomb maniac, but I'm a huge fan of the band, and I wanted to go. But honestly, I slept on it and didn't get a ticket. And missed my chance.
Oh.
I know they have a second to final last show, but honestly, I kind of only want to go to the last show, or both shows. But I wouldn't go to both shows because, I mean, man, it's brutal. Tolls from Philadelphia to Brooklyn. Adam, what do you think tolls are round trip from Philadelphia to Brooklyn?
I'm the worst person you could ask that because we don't have road tolls in this province, so I have no comparative.
Chris, what do you think tolls are from Philadelphia to Brooklyn?
Round trip.
Round trip.
Are you going to go through Staten Island, or are you going to go through the tunnels of Manhattan?
I don't know. Not through Manhattan, I don't think.
Not through Manhattan? Okay, so if you go through Staten Island, let's see, 15, Turnpike, 10. I want to save about like a good $30.
Close, man. $54 plus gas, which is like another $40. So it's like $100. I actually would spend $100 to see Bomb the Music Industry, but I slept on getting tickets, and I don't want to pay some scalper for them. So if I get hooked up somewhere, I'll probably go to the last show. But I really want to get that last live recording. I'd love to see the last Bomb the Music Industry show. However, I saw their second to last California tour, which at the time was advertised for the last California tour. I saw them three times in a row. I think it was 3 days. Every show was different. Every show was phenomenal. People, if you can go to this show, don't miss out on this show. It's a good show.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, go see them if you can, if you're a fan. So,
I guess you want to plug this publishing odyssey that we've embarked upon with some Bomb the Music Industry stuff. Yeah.
Yes, I do. And actually, you know, I didn't even do this. I didn't even put the story in our thing to plug it because actually, we set the story up before it ran today. But the point is over at the Punk News Tumblr, I know Brittany Strummer has taken the initiative and she's going to put more original stuff over at the Punk News Tumblr. I think the stuff over the Punk News Tumblr is going to be a little bit more experimental or a little bit less, I guess, newsy and more like, I don't know how to put it, like Esquire-ish, if that's how you want to look at it. More of a story than just news or information. So one of the first things we're doing over there is way back about 2 years ago, I saw the, quote, last three Bomb the Music Industry California shows. They actually did a tour after that, but at the time everyone thought it was the last three California shows. And so I actually covered it and did it kind of like an Esquire article, and it's going to be 10 pieces. The first piece ran today. We're going to run a piece a day. So really, by the time you hear this, there'll probably be 7 or 8 pieces that have run. And it basically documents my experience going to see Bomb the Music Industry 3 times. I interview Bomb the Music Industry. I interview the show promoter. I interview Classics of Love with Jesse Michaels and the Hard Girls. I interview Gnar Boots, and I interview somebody. Mike Park. We talked to Mike Park. And Kepi Ghoulie's there. And so it's not just a show review of Bomb the Music Industry. It's a description of everything surrounding their last 3 shows. So I'm pretty proud of it. We reworked it a little bit, and I think it's in its best shape now. But it's an unusual piece. But, I mean, if you like Bomb the Music Industry, I say check it out. It seems people are reacting pretty positively to it. So,
cool. Well, yeah, we, you know, this piece of writing has been, like, kicking around the punk news world for, like, oh, God.
2 years.
Two years? Jesus. So,
2 years.
Yeah, so it's a complete shame that it hasn't actually seen the light of day until now. But, you know, hopefully we can turns people on to seeing it.
Better late than never.
It is a shame, but honestly, I do think it's in its best format now, to tell you the truth. I think it's been in 3 forms, basically, and I think this is its best iteration. And so I think it does justice to the band, and I think people enjoy reading it. But like I said, it's not a wham-bam thing like Bomb the Music Industry came out, play this, this, and this. It's more of a description of the journey, seeing them and seeing the people around them and what people's thoughts are. So think of it like a written documentary as opposed to a show review.
Yeah. So if you want to read this thing and other things that we're going to be putting on the Tumblr there, it's just punknews.tumblr.com, and you can find it there along with, you know, actual links to stuff that we've posted that are news and other things like that. So anyways, yeah. So go check out the Punk News Tumblr, which is on Tumblr. So there you go. Next up here, we're going to talk about a band that, Chris, you're probably going to be our expert in.
Oh, boy.
Here we go. I'm not quite sure. So anyways, I mean, it's weird whenever we talk about the Gaslight Anthem on this podcast, because they're a huge band. They're a huge band for punk news purposes, but we never seem to have like quite the right amount of people on the show that actually know anything about them to do them justice, and it sounds flippant, but I don't know. Anyways, Gaslight's releasing a B-Sides collection. This is going to precede the release of their 2014 LP. So it's going to be a rarities collection titled The B-Sides. It's coming out on January 28th. Now, fans are just speculating what is going to be on it right now, but they're thinking it's going to compile the 7 inches that the band previously released in their more elaborate and expensive box set back in June. Really, we don't know what's going to be on this thing in terms of track listing yet. So, yeah.
Actually, I have the track list. Let me just pull it
Why don't I know this?
Because I just figured it out now. Just give me
Well, this is why I said you were officially the expert in this. So, okay.
Breaking news on the Punk News Podcast.
The track list. Hold on. I'm on my handy-dandy trusty resource. And I believe it was 17 tracks, if I'm not mistaken, as I'm scrolling through now. The track listing, She Loves You, The 59 Sound Acoustic, State of Love and Trust Live, Tumbling Dice, Queen of Lord Chelsea Acoustic, Songs for Teenagers, I believe that is a Fake Problems cover, Great Expectations Acoustic, Antonia Jane Acoustic, American Slang Acoustic, Boxer Acoustic, and Once Upon a Time. I'm sorry, it wasn't 17 tracks, it was 11. But I do believe this is coming out on Psy One Dummy Records, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that. And the cover art has been put out as well. Of course, it has to do with a record playing on a Crosley, which is a little insulting. But okay. Yeah, so it seems like it's taken a good chunk from that huge 7-inch box set, as Adam just alluded to. And, you know, for me, I passed on that box set because I know people like 7 inches, and there's a whole different discussion I can have about 7 inches as well. I generally don't have anything against 7 inches, but just 7-inch box sets, I think I own one, and it's something that is just, if you want to go through it, you'll be at your turntable basically most of the day. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying music on your turntable, but just something about flipping every one or two songs that just I can't handle after a certain point. So it's nice to see that they actually have put it together on an LP for everyone. I don't think it has everything from that box set, though, so there may be still be perks to it. I know some super fans are upset because they feel like, oh, here we go again. You just put out the box set. Now you're going to put it out in LP form. But for those that did pass on it or who just want a cheaper, more accessible version of it, I'm not going to argue against putting it on an LP. So I probably will purchase this when they do put it up for pre-order as well. So
I knew something about this band, because like whenever Gaslight's on here, I'm just like, dang, you know, Chris Moran is from Richmond, and that's really about all I can contribute.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, I've enjoyed the stuff they put out recently. My favorite stuff from them is obviously the first album, and from there, it's kind of been hit or miss for me. So I still do enjoy them, you know. And so, some of these tracks are on other 7-inches that I own, so it'd be nice not to just have to pull all of them out. So I plan on keeping them for collective purposes. So yeah, I mean, I know some people are really going to think it's just a cash grab and another way to rehash it, but I mean, you know, if you don't want it, you don't have to buy it. You just wait for the LP that's supposed to come out next year, or at some point next year, 2014, 2015. We'll see how that goes. So, I mean, I'm stoked for it.
Cool. So, switching gears to something that I've for some reason thought way more about than I feel that I need to. But the album of Everly Brothers covers that Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day and I don't know what genre to classify her as, Norah Jones, recorded together, can actually be listened to in its entirety at Amazon was doing it. This might be one of these American things. I could not listen to it in its entirety. I could listen to a bunch of 30-second clips from it. So hopefully that actually gave me enough fodder to talk about it. But anyways, the record is due out on the yesterday. I think it was due out on the today. The yesterday. 25th of November. Records don't come out on... Okay, whatever. It's due out this week. So anyways... what are we to take from this? The reaction of our listeners the readers have just been sort of befuddled. No one's too, I think, extremely angry or irritated about this, because I don't think Norah Jones is, you know, like, a singer that plays mostly adult contemporary music is not really a lightning rod for controversy anyways, so it hasn't really caused that sort of uproar, but it's definitely not, I think, on the list of things that people would have expected Billy Joe to do. So what do you guys take from this? John?
I listened to the record. The record isn't like mind-blowingly good, but it's not terrible either. I mean, it's basically exactly what it sounds like. It's Billie Joe Armstrong and Norah Jones doing fairly faithful versions of Everly Brothers tunes. It's kind of a, I hate to put it this way, but it's a fun throwaway. It's something you might put on once in a while. If you like Billie Joe or if you like Norah Jones, you know, you'll dig it, but it's not, no one's going to be like, this record changed my life. It's just a couple people having fun. People are like, well, what's the deal with this? But honestly, I kind of approve of stuff like this, because back in the 70s, when record labels were putting out thousands of records, like, they would do this kind of stuff all the time. Like, I'm a pretty big Roxy Music fan. Brian Ferry, the main Roxy Music guy, his first three albums are just all covers because they just wanted him to put out material. And honestly, they're all pretty good, you know? I mean, they're not earth-shattering. But, you know, not every record needs to be earth-shattering. There's nothing wrong with a fun, light record. And also, like, a lot of people might not – I haven't expected this. I think it's good when your favorite musicians do things that aren't unexpected. It challenges you and maybe shows you the birth, I don't know if I'm using that word correctly, but the grasp of their talent, the size of their talent. And I think this kind of answers it in that, you know, it's a cool record, but it's not mind-blowingly good, which I think answers how far does Billy Joe's talent reach. It's a cool record. You know, I think it's cool. I think more bands should do things that aren't perhaps quite as contemplated and are just fun to bang out. So, yeah, I mean, I give it thumbs up, but I wouldn't say it's anything anybody needs to have. But if you like this kind of stuff, it's cool. That's what I'm saying.
Didn't Billy Joe try to dabble outside of something out of Green Day, not just Pinhead Gunpowder, but also not to say that that's really far from it, but Foxborough Hot Tubs? Anybody remember that?
Yeah, well, that's just Green Day doing like Chuck Berry kind of music.
I mean, if you want to put it like that, yeah, I mean, pretty much.
Well, they also had that that band. What was it? The Network.
Network.
That was, I don't know, but like synthy or something like that. I'm trying to remember what they sounded like. Didn't they sort of sound like the Epoxies, but more or less they sounded like Green Day?
Yeah, that's about
like,
right.
Like, I think, like, the intent was that they were going to do, like, you know, like, let's do something that's, like, you know, like, really, like, you know, kitschy and, like, early new wavy, but then it just kind of sounded like Green Day, and people were like, oh, this is Green Day, but there's a synth sometimes.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then anytime Billy Joe is singing on something, could you just say, oh, it's Billy Joe? It must be, you know. It's
no, Green no, Day because this, like, it was like, I think it's because, like, at least on the Network record, if I remember correctly, like, you know, someone can venture outside of their comfort zone and do something different, or they can do something that's more or less in their comfort zone with a different name. And this was that.
You mean the Network or this Norah Jones record?
No, the Network thing. I mean, the Norah Jones is outside of like what you'd expect Billy Joe to do, but the Network thing was just like, if this was a Green Day record, it would not be a good one.
Yeah.
But you know, it kind of got by on the fact that there was like at least like a few weeks worth of, I don't know, mystery over whether Green Day was the Network, which is, God, that's a boring mystery to have lived through.
I felt like didn't they do that with Foxborough Hot Tubs too? That they kind of made who is this Foxborough Hot Tubs band?
Yeah, I feel that Green Day does a lot of stuff to try to, I don't know, play up a little bit more of a narrative around the band, but a lot of it sounds really calculated, I think, when it comes out.
We need another Billy Joe meltdown.
Yeah, like that was at least something that I don't think they planned on. So that's what made that interesting.
And I just will never get over the fact that Mike Dirt just looked at Billy Joe starting to smash his guitar and was like, ah, shit, why not? I'll join in too.
Well, you're there. You're not just going to stand around like a dope, right?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you're going to follow that model, then wasn't Screeching Weasel supposed to also go in and beat the crowd? I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, they kind of were. I mean, back in the day, that's what would happen. I mean, like, look at the dwarves. I mean, it's kind of the dwarf. Like, when somebody would attack somebody in the dwarves, all the dwarves would jump in and just start beating the crap out of them. Or, you know, if somebody gets on stage and wrecks the drums or whatever, the whole band just starts smashing everything. That's what bands used to do back in the day. I'm so torn on the concept of instrument smashing because, on one hand, I'm like, that's an interesting artistic statement to say. But on the other hand, I'm like, man, how wasteful. He could have given that guitar to a poor kid that really could have learned to love it, you know? So I'm torn on instrument smashing.
They could have auctioned it for charity. Toys for Tots, something.
Ah, but right? you could auction a smash guitar for charity. Hmm.
The frame piece. I see what you did there. Why not?
Wow.
So, I mean, the you're able to play these things? I thought they were just reframing. So.
Oh, boy. So, I mean, since John, there's something that you said about this earlier that you know, that bands should do more things that are sort of, you know, they don't need to be important, and they're just, you know, done on a little bit of a lark just to kind of see what happens. And if you want one of those that is worlds better than Billy Joe and Norah Jones, at least worlds more interesting, go pick up John Doe and the Sadies Country Club.
Mm.
So this is John Doe from X, of course, and the Sadies, which are like an amazing Canadian alt country band that have backed Nico Case on a bunch of records, and are generally good in their own. They put out this a covers album last year, the year before, in recent memory, where they just played, you know, a bunch of just kind of like old Nashville standards and stuff like that. That they, you know, there's, you know, it's them covering like Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings songs, and you know, it goes a little bit beyond this Everly Brothers thing, only in that there's a couple, I'm pretty sure there's a couple originals on there that feature John and Xena Cervenka, actually. So yeah, so if you like X or the Sadies, and you should like both, and you like things that are slightly more interesting than this but still in the same sort of nostalgic tilt, yeah, go find Country Club. It came out on, let me see here, Yep Rock released it in 2009. Okay, it's a few years older than I thought. So yeah, go get that. It's better. And
all right.
Yeah, just do it. Okay. Here we go. Do we have any music? We don't have any music. There's none that we've planned.
We could dig up something if we want.
I feel like we should play something before I move on to this next story, because
you think we need the emotional break?
I think we are going to need to be in a better mental place to process this one.
Well, I've got a selection here. Well, do you have something in mind, Adam?
No.
Do you want happy music, sad music, or music about how humanity is damned and is evil?
I opt for the third one.
Yeah, I think it's fitting. Let's play something by Integrity. Integrity just put I guess a lot of the punk news listeners know. Integrity is they play what's called Holy Terror, which is basically a raw, aggressive form of heavy metal. And they're led by a guy called Dwed Hellion. Recently, their newest records have just been Dwed Hellion and a guy named Robert Orr. And a lot of their music is about how humanity is evil and should be destroyed. Like, Dwed Hellion, like, believes that, like, humanity should be destroyed. So they put out a new record this year called Suicide Black Snake, and this is one of the tracks off of it, and it is called Detonate World's Plague.
we're back. I hope you're all right pissed off, because here we go. So, Ian Watkins, previously of the recently disbanded band Lost Prophets, has pleaded guilty to 11 child sex offenses, as reported in UK news publication The Guardian. The specifics of the charges, they're not pretty, and if you'd really rather not hear them, by all means, hit that little jump ahead 15 seconds button that's in the iTunes.
I think we might need about 30 seconds or a minute or
yeah,
more.
just lay into that skip ahead button. All right, so Watkins has admitted to 2 counts of attempted rape and sexual assault of a child under the age of 13, but not to rape, the BBC News reports. In addition, Watkins has pleaded guilty to 3 counts of sexual assault involving children and 6 involving taking, making, or possessing indecent images of children, and 1 possessing an extreme pornographic image involving a sex act on an animal. So this is where this horrible story has ended up. If you want more, you can find the information on BBC News. There was something on the BBC that wasn't in the Punk News story, actually, that involves the attempted rape of a baby, and I have no idea even what anything is here. So he's pleaded guilty to all of this stuff. He had previously, and this is a quote, furiously denied all of the allegations on this. So this is where the story of Lost Prophet singer Ian Watkins ends. I don't know.
I think that sums it up well. Just the kind of awkward kind of like silence. Like, what do you say? What do you say about someone
God, if you guys, I mean, if anyone really wants all the sick details of this, go look at the BBC News stories. There's all sorts of, like, really disturbing shit that is in there about how he was planning to teach the babies how to take drugs. And just, like, there's all sorts of stuff in there that just is totally horrible.
But, it gets worse than that if you ask me.
I'm just skimming through it and picking out things that offend me, so there's more.
I mean, this guy is one sick puppy, let me tell you. I mean, honestly, I don't even know how you get that messed up. I gotta assume this guy was raped as a kid himself or something. I mean, this guy is sick. I mean, this is one of the sickest things I've ever heard, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, this is up there. It definitely is. I mean, it's one thing to get in a fight, stomp someone on stage, stab somebody, shoot somebody, armed robbery.
Bette Weasel's looking pretty good these days.
I think potentially to the North American punk news listenership, it's a little bit less apparent how big of a band Lost Prophets was. They're from South Wales. They were formed in 1997. The band released 5 albums in that time, and they sold about 3.5 million records worldwide. At least in the UK, they received pretty heavy airplay on mainstream radio stations. I don't know about North America in that respect, because I just don't. And they were always like a staple of, you know, big UK music festivals. So they played like Reading and Leeds and stuff like that all the time. So they were a big band in the UK. So this is, you know, for us, we're looking at the story and going like, wow, this fucker is incredibly sick. But in the UK, like on top of that, this band had some resonance to like a huge number of people.
I mean, I can imagine that. Yeah, I mean, if you have fans like that, I can imagine that there are a few that still don't believe, you know, that kind of look at it through rose-colored glasses about it. That, oh, you know, I don't, for whatever reason they concocted up that a guy would plead guilty to all this. And I don't know. I mean, you can't really just pull these charges out of left field. It's not like something you could just walk into somebody's house and be like, hey, you got a, you know, child pornography on your computer. That's not something you just walk into someone's house and they have. On an own basis, and nor should it be that way. So yeah, that's pretty awful. I mean, we're gonna have to pull out a whole list of adjectives for this.
So So anyways, yeah, you again, you can find all sorts of details on this if you really want them on the BBC is probably the best place to find them. It is, like, at the moment, I mean, if you look at it, like, it is the number one story right now on the BBC, like, in terms of, like, their most read things, you know. Singer guilty of attempted baby rape is like number one above, you know, anything else that's happening in the world right now. So big story for everyone in the US, or in the UK, you know. So that, yeah,
he claims he was a victim of a malicious campaign.
That was his old story, but that was
I understand.
Yeah.
I just like who would make up charges like that? I'm trying to think of beyond the thinking of reasons why he would do things or even plot or think things like this. Why would someone make up something this detailed?
It doesn't matter. I'm assuming England's like America. I don't know about the English criminal system, but I assume it's similar. Is that you don't have to prove why somebody would do something. You only have to prove that there's a reasonable doubt. So even if the scenario that you propose is like bizarre and is highly unlikely, as long as you create an unreasonable doubt, you don't have to explain an alternate situation. You just have to explain that it's possible an alternate situation exists, could exist, and therefore there is a reasonable doubt as to whether or not you're guilty.
I mean,
a good example is OJ. Like,
great example.
Who's going to go knife up OJ's ex-wife and her new boyfriend? Well, probably OJ, right? But could it have been somebody else? Well, it could have. You know, that's not likely and it's not the most logical thing, but it's possible, and it's possible enough to create a reasonable doubt in our mind. So, you know, obviously Ian Watkins' legal team, I don't want to say they were panicking, but they were throwing up walls to protect their future interests. And so they were just saying, well, let's just throw something out there to create a reasonable doubt as to whether or not he was guilty. But obviously the evidence was so ironclad against him, they just had to throw in the towel and say, yeah, he did pretty much do the worst things ever conceived ever.
Yeah. But that's what's even more mind-boggling about that is that, you know, the team wasn't able to come together and just – not that I really want them to come together and try and put reasonable doubt in people's minds if it's true. But so much that you didn't even try to bring it to trial. And I guess – I don't know. Maybe we were spared more other awful details not happening.
Chris, you got to remember, this is a pretty quick time frame. I mean, most people, as soon as they're accused of something, they say not guilty, you know, because you can always go from not guilty to guilty. You can't go from guilty to not guilty.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, as soon as you get accused, they start throwing up stuff. But then the DA has more evidence and more evidence and more evidence. And then you realize, oh, I got a plea bargain or else I'm really going down, you know. And he's really going down anyways, but he's probably going down slightly less than had he pled not guilty and been convicted.
Oh, well, that's fun.
All right. Well, let's move on from that. God. So, okay, this next story I think is incredibly interesting for all sorts of reasons. There has been a bit of an explosion between a toy company called Goldie Blocks and the Beastie Boys, the surviving members of the Beastie Boys, regarding a viral video that the Goldie Blocks people created and posted online. So I'll read through the story here. Anyways, though, so the surviving Beastie Boys and the estate of the late Adam Yauch have been sued by a company after that company misappropriated their 1987 song for a commercial. So the suit, which was filed by Goldie Blocks, seeks injunctive relief and a declaratory ruling against the Beastie Boys, stating that the use of the song in the, or at least their version of the song, in this YouTube video that they put up was legal. Now, John, I'll get to that with you in a sec, because I'm sure you have a lot to say about that. So anyways, Goldie Blocks is a girl-focused toy company here. They make, like, engineering toys for girls. The video itself, if you guys haven't seen it, and it sort of blew up on the internet earlier in the week, basically takes the music more or less, from the Beastie Boys Girls, rewrites the lyrics, and uses it to, well, really to kind of like promote like a very, and I think this is what screwed everyone up, is to promote a very, you know, positive message and something that not a lot of people are going to disagree with. Now, where the Beasties are coming at it from is they're saying, well, sure, you know, it seems like the message they're trying to portray is positive, but it's still an ad, and we still don't want our stuff in advertising. Adam Yauch, before he died, expressly forbade the use of his music or image in advertising. This was in his will. So instead of respecting this, Goldie Blox used the song in the commercial and then basically sued the Beastie Boys, Def Jam Records, Sony, Rick Rubin, Adam Horowitz, in an effort that... at least we as in, I guess, Aubin, writer of our article here, feel might be a little bit of a free publicity ploy. So the Beasties themselves, they posted an open letter to this in, I think it was in the New York Post, Times? I don't know. We don't say.
I think it was through their press agent, and it just got picked up by some people.
All right. So anyways, so this is what the Beasties said. They said, like many of the millions of people who have seen your commercial, which is titled Goldie Blox, Rube Goldberg, and the Beastie Boys, we're very impressed by the creativity and the message behind your ad. We strongly support empowering young girls, breaking down gender stereotypes, and igniting a passion for technology and engineering. As creative as it is, make no mistake, your video is an advertisement that is designed to sell a product. And long ago, we made a conscious decision not to permit our music and or name to be used in product ads. When we tried to simply ask how and why our song, Girls, had been used in your ad without our permission, you sued us. So that's kind of where this has been left. There's been all sorts of commentary all over the internet about this. I want to talk about that in a minute. But John, as our resident Saul Goodman, can you give us some insight on this?
Yes. Here's what happens is... when you use when you own a artistic work, be it a song, be it a sound recording, be it a statue, be it whatever, you have the rights to copy it, to distribute it, to make derivative works of it. The only way anybody else can use that material is if they have your permission, or if there's fair use. Fair use is basically an incredibly essential law, or not law, but it, well, yeah, law in American copyright law, and I assume it's fair use in Canada and probably most countries, that says you can use other people's material for certain purposes. Some of it would be criticism. For example, you know how we quote like bands sometimes in our articles? That's technically copyright infringement. I mean, their songs, that's technically copyright infringement, but it's not because it's fair use for criticism or news reporting. Other reasons would be for parody or satire. Now, anytime anything like this happens, there's always someone that says, that is absolutely fair use, or something that is absolutely not fair use. Anytime anybody says that it absolutely is or absolutely is not fair use, shows they don't know what they're talking about, and here's why. You do not know if something is fair use until the judge himself in trial says this is or is not fair use. Here's how the court determines if something is fair use. When determining if something is fair use, the court looks at four factors and weighs them. They're supposed to weigh them equally, but they don't really, on whether or not something is considered fair use. The four factors are the purpose and character of use. Is it for commercial nature? Is it non-commercial? Is it for education? Is it for satire? The second is the nature of the copyright work. Is it based off real facts? Is it something of pure fiction? The third factor is the amount used. Did they just use a 3-second sample, or did they use the whole thing? The fourth one would be the effect upon the potential market for the underlying work. That is, are you financially hurting the person that owns the work through your parody, through your satire, or whatever? And I got to say, if I was forced to guess, I would say that Goldie Blox would probably win in this because, generally speaking, the court lays very heavily in favor of fair use, particularly here where Goldie Blox can argue, well, Girl is a misogynistic song. We're pointing out that we're not making a misogynistic song anymore. So, I mean, that's a pretty strong argument for fair use. What the Beastie Boys could counter with is they could say, well, A, we don't license any of our tunes. Therefore, you're hurting us extremely commercial. You're extremely hurting our commercial prospects. B, they can also argue that you used the entirety of the song, not just a little bit. Although, on the other hand, you know, Weird Al covers does parodies of entire songs all the time, and he doesn't get sued. You know, So I don't know if that's a great argument. So I would have to say that most likely Goldie Blocks would probably win this. But two things is going to happen. I can almost guarantee you this is going to settle. But also, if this does go to trial, which I don't think it will, but if it does, I hope Goldie Blocks loses. I can't stand this company, and here's why. They put up, like, the most dismissive, nasty post about this after the Beastie Boys posted their thing. Goldie Blocks put up an article that says, let's ask an actual expert, which I thought was, like, disgraceful. Like, how dare you, like, talk hate on the Beastie Boys like that? I mean, the Beastie Boys are one of the foremost proponents of treating people equally and equal rights and gender equality. I mean, in the late 80s in hip hop, there were a lot of misogynistic lyrics. Not all hip hop was that way, but some hip hop was. The Beastie Boys, I would say, were the very first group to really make that, well, maybe not, were one of the loudest groups to make their stance that say, we are for gender equality, we are for social equality, and all that. And this little ratty ass company that's making money, quite clearly is making money off that song, is in trashing the Beastie Boys. How dare you? Particularly after Adam Young said, I really don't want any of my music to be used in any commercials. So Freedom of Speech Fair Use John says, well, I hope Goldie Blocks wins. But Beastie Boys fan John says, I hope Goldie Blocks loses. And I think on this scenario, Beastie Boys John fan wins. But if Goldie Blocks did win this, I could understand and I could support that decision as a reaffirmation of our freedom of speech and fair use and creativity in the United States.
You see, I think that this was such a weird thing to see come up because I've been aware of Goldie Blocks as a company, I think ever since our daughter was born, because that was the kind of thing that I was really looking for was, you know, I'm curious to see like what kind of like, you know, when she's old enough to play with this kind of stuff, you know, toys are out there that are not like completely gender coded. So it was something that I was really aware of. And Goldie Blocks has made a lot of noise in that space, you know, in trying to teach math and science and engineering to girls. So, okay, great. And when this ad first came out, when I first saw it, it did not even pop into my head that there was a potential issue with use of the song, because I just watched it and said, oh, look, I love this company. Hey, this is pretty creative. And I remember like that was my initial impression of it. What I think that has left a bad taste in my mouth is exactly what you said, where the comments from the company about this have not at all been cordial. They've been quite combative. You know, there's been no like no amount of contrition, no amount of trying to say that, you know, oh, you know, sorry, it was just a YouTube thing. We thought it was a good, you know, we support a good cause, you know, we respect the Beasties, we'll take it down. Like, there was nothing like that, right? It was all just like, no, we're going to fight this. I mean, the fact that they sued, right? Like, they're the ones that brought the suit is, and even at that first moment when it was first made known that, no, they were looking for an injunction, I thought initially that, okay, maybe this is one of these things where, you know, the Beasties lawyers and their lawyers were, you know, butting heads a little bit with legalese, and the players behind it maybe weren't necessarily as acrimonious as that. But no, everything that we've seen come out of Goldie Blocks about this has been fairly combative. I think one of the most interesting things that I saw was someone was saying that maybe this is a really calculated intent to use the Streisand effect on their part. Now, are you guys aware of this?
No, I'm not.
Enlighten me.
Okay. So the Streisand effect, I want to say I'm almost positive that it was something that was it coined by, yeah, okay, here it is. So the Streisand effect, this is straight out of my pool of knowledge, which is Wikipedia here, is a phenomenon whereby any attempt to hide, remove, or censor a piece of information has the unintended consequence of publicizing the information more widely, usually facilitated by the internet. So the question is, like, did they put this video up knowing full and well that it was going to cause a stink with the Beasties, and knowing full and well that all of a sudden, you know, places like this, places like Punk News, places like a bunch of tech blogs are all of a sudden going to be talking about their product specifically because of the lawsuit and the controversy that had been created by it. So now the reason that the Streisand effect exists, it was named after Barbara Streisand, who attempted in 2003 to suppress photographs of her residence in Malibu. And when I forget why, you can look this up if you want to see. Basically, there are photos of her house that went up online or went up somewhere, and she went to such crazy lengths to try to get these photos offline that the internet kind of turned around and said, well, hey, we got to publish these photographs everywhere, and then it was everywhere. So the question is, like, you know, was this some sort of calculated move where, like, someone said, you know what, no matter how mad the Beasties get about this, they're still the Beastie Boys. They're not going to destroy us. So, you know, it's you know, we're coming up on Christmas season. Everyone's, you know, there's still some time to get some online shopping in. We caused, you know, a medium controversy with this that really doesn't say anything bad about our product. It actually says good things about our product, but, you know, might say some, we can turn around and blame it on lawyers after the fact. And all of a sudden our name has been everywhere pre-Christmas and lots of people are on our website looking at the toys. Like, yeah, I wonder if that's it.
I mean, to be honest with you, I didn't hear of this company until this issue came up. So, I mean, if they want to, you know, it's almost like, I hate to make this comparison, maybe people cringe, but it's almost like kind of like, I feel like Miley Cyrus is the troll of 2013. But so much of her doing troll-worthy things like the performance with the cat and, you know, with the bears are dancing over Robin Thicke and all that, it's so much just to be in people's minds. And, you know, just have people talk about them. So I don't think it's that far-fetched to say that that they, not necessarily they calculated every move of it, but certainly, you know, any publicity is good publicity. And I guess in the case of this company, who I had never heard of before this, it's publicity for them without even watching the ad or anything. So I think it's something for them. Absolutely. I just find it hilarious that they sued the Beastie Boys over this, it wasn't the other way around.
Well, and then that's what's really was making me wonder at first, like, you know, is this something where, you know, that they perhaps got, you know, the initial letter or whatever from the Beasties, and then their own lawyers went, oh shit, we gotta nip this thing, let's file an injunction, right? So
that's probably what happened. The same exact thing happened with Robin Thicke and George Clinton earlier this year, and Marvin Gaye, same exact thing.
So, you know, it's been a really weird story to see covered, I think, in general, only because, like, I think that the coverage on Boing Boing, the really popular blog, has been completely baffling to me, because, like, if you look at, like, the kind of stuff that, say, like, Boing Boing posts, they would normally be a blog that would be very pro Beastie Boys, just in terms of, like, the kind of stuff that they cover and the age of the writers that work on there. Now, but they're also, you know, they're also really big on, I want to say, like, the message that Goldilocks has been putting across, this, you know, promoting math and engineering and science to girls. They're really big with this whole, like, maker movement and all that. And at the same time, they have a huge amount to say from a very activist perspective about copyright, about, you know, use of information. So it was kind of like all of their competing interests all of a sudden sort of collided in this, where you could tell they wrote very awkward articles where, like, you know, they support what Goldie is doing and they support information freedom, and isn't it stupid that, you know, copyright exists at all in this case, but at the same time we like the Beastie Boys, and oh, it's was the dying wish of one of the members. and it's kind of like they could not have written more, like, trying to have their cake and eat it commentary on this, and it all came out really weird to me. And I love Boing Boing, don't get me wrong, they're a great resource, but this was clearly something where, like, you know, there was no pure villain in it, and they had a really hard time, you know, wrapping that.
Strange situation.
Yeah. So, anyways, that's still ongoing. There's nothing has been decided about that. We can keep going here. How are we doing for time? We got a lot of stuff still. This has been a big week.
Yeah.
I have no idea what we're doing for time. Let's throw a few in here.
We can probably rip through these things kind of quick if we want.
Yeah, okay. This first one is sort of a non-story. So there were some comments that showed up in Billboard this week from Clash members Mick Jones and Paul Simonson, about the their continuing decision not to reunite the band, which would seem pretty obvious given the death of Joe Strummer, but there are some quotes that you will probably want to read. Simonon says, it's a better story at the end of the day that we didn't get back together. We saved all that time and effort by not reforming. It seems that we would have squandered what we would have achieved by reforming. Why do people get together? Why do bands reform? Oh, they're good mates. Well, that's nice, but it usually because there's a financial situation that has to be adhered to. Basically, everyone's broke. So that was submitted on it. Jones said, our band is an idea as well. It's kind of said, you can do this. We can say that now in retrospect, and we can sort of understand it. When we did it, we just did it instinctively, and no one thought of the future significance. So anyways, you can find links to the full interview that's on Billboard, on Punk News. Any comments on the Clash not reforming, which is actually the same as last week when the Clash didn't reform?
Just real quick, is I know there was rumors they actually were going to reform, like right after Joe Strummer died. A lot of people take the stance, you know, reunions are always bad, but I disagree. Sometimes I think reunions are better than the original run. So, I mean, Amoebics, when I saw Amoebics in 2008, so awesome, one of the best shows I ever saw. Probably better than they used to be. They just sounded so much better. When I saw Flag was so phenomenal. I'm so happy I got to see that. When I saw Zounds, it was great. When I saw Antisect, it was great. So I generally like reunions, but I mean, I'm not going to deny that Clash never reunited because they were pretty bulletproof all throughout their career. So if that's the way it's got to be, that's the way it's got to be. But I am not anti-reunions.
Well, I guess an interesting thing here is that you mentioned Flag because, like, Flag to me is, like, one of the ways that they could do it. Like, and, you know,
just, or as the Lash?
Or well, maybe not as the Lash, but you know what? Like, hey, if those guys want to go on stage and play those songs together because they're their songs, then cool. Just don't call it the Clash. I mean, like, Mick Jones played, he came out on stage and played with Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros, and they, you know, a bit. And there are a few of those songs.
That's a sweet live album.
Yeah. Right, yeah. They ended up, it was like, yeah. Like live, it was like a UK Fire Hall or Fireman's Benefit or something like that, right? What was it?
It is something like that. It's like Joe Strummer, Mick Jones get together for a fireman's. I just imagine like a firehouse and like Mick Jones and Joe Strummer come in. It's like, all right, guys, let's play some tunes. You know,
yeah.
But I mean, so that live slide album, down the pole.
That live album is pretty bang. And
right. So that's cool. I think that's the key. Is that, you know, they recognize that, you know what? Yeah, we're doing this for fun, but the band is over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Another good way to do it is I think Jello and Rob Halford does it the best. If you go see Jello live, he does songs from throughout his career, which is great for two reasons. A, you never know what you're going to hear live, and B, you hear like a lot of everything, and it's all like really good. So I love it when bands like play their earliest stuff. They're like, well, I mean, when someone who has been in a lot of bands plays stuff in all the bands, and that way it doesn't, quote, cheapen their legacy, because Jello's not like, I'm the Dead Kennedy. I'm Jello Biafra, and I wrote Someday Kennedy songs, so I'll do some of them. I'll do some Lard songs. I'll do some of my new stuff, and that's the way to do it, if you ask me.
Cool, I don't disagree at all. All right, let's jump on to the next one here. We're just like from a high to a low. Okay, so Ronnie Radke, is that how you spell say his name?
Radke, that's it.
Radke, I'm not super familiar. You would know.
Yeah.
So after displaying some of his newfound rapping skills on the Falling in Reverse album Fashionably Late and claiming that he'd been in rap since I was shitting in Pampers, frontman Ronnie Radke, the punk news clown, it seems these days, is taking it a step further. He told Loudwire about plans for a mixtape that will also feature Danny Worsnip of Asking Alexandria, Jacoby Shaddix of Papa Roach, Andy Biersack of Black Veil Brides, and other people who I don't know or have never heard of. Is there anything to say about this aside from the fact that we like posting stories about this person because it just gets people angry?
I would love to interview people that like say, yes, I'm so excited for this, and see, do they really enjoy this? Do they really enjoy Adam like you and I might enjoy, I don't know, DOA or Classics of Love or something like that? Or is it really all hype? And if they sat down and listened to it, they don't actually enjoy I really don't know.
I mean, unfortunately, someone has to enjoy it. I mean, there has to be money put in and some money made back from it. So, I mean, I can't – I mean, you know, even if you look at, like, Rise Records with Attack Attack.
But I'm saying, like, do those kids really like that? Or is it all hype and they just all act like they like it?
You know, I worked in a high school a few years ago, and there were a few kids who liked I Wrestled a Bear once and stuff like that. And no, I honestly do think in some way. I mean, is it like, are you trying to relate it to certain pop music that people like certain pop music just because it's popular? Or do they actually like it?
Do they not realize how incredibly stupid this is? I mean, that's my point. You know, it's a rich white kid kind of adopting like some gangster mannerisms, and it's so phony and so manufactured and so cheesy. Like, do they not realize that? Or do they just like it because everyone else hates it so much?
Think about the people he's trying to relate it to. I mean, do you know people that are like, or have you ever seen?
I don't.
I mean, not personally, like, hey, what's going on? Like, here's my friend who's trying real hard to do things or whatever. But you know what I mean? There's people that actually exist like that. So there's a market. If something like this is available, there's a market. And I mean, as much as it's sad to say, someone out there is like, bro, it speaks to me. You know,
I would love to
meet that person.
I would love to interview that person. I really would.
So I don't think we can mention Ronnie Radke without mentioning why he is so, I guess, such a running joke amongst the punk news readership. So Ronnie used to be a vocalist of a band called Escape the Fate, which was one of those kind of like, I don't even know what the genre you would call it, one of those like latter day mall screamo bands that Epitaph signed when Epitaph started signing bands that a lot of us didn't really understand. So he spent around, he went to prison in, let's see, 2008 for violating parole. Earlier than that, he was involved in a fight that led to the death of a man, and while another man was actually charged with that murder, he was charged and convicted of battery for his involvement in the situation. So, not only is this person sort of like a living cartoon character, but he may have sort of killed a guy at one point.
But if you ask me, the best part is it's not like he's 19 or 17, he's like 32. Adam, he's our age, and he's still wrapping up. He's our age, and this is what he's saying. White boy on the beat, rocking Gucci sneaks. All I do is win, Charlie Sheen. Started out in 06 and revived the scene. So many mother effers want to be like me. This is like a 32-year-old.
He's a seasoned vet.
Yeah. you weren't dropping rhymes like that earlier? I was, like around like 6 tonight.
Chris, you, me, and Adam are starting a new hip-hop supergroup, and we're going full-out Ronnie Radke style. We'll grow the hair, we'll get the sneaks, we'll get the full-arm tattoos, and we'll just be like, yo, this is spitting sick rhymes anytime. You know I'm fine. Girl, call my cell. We will dwell. I'll take you to hell, and I'll ring your bell. This is Johnny G, 2013, fresh.
Oh man.
You've been sitting on those lyrics for like better part of a year.
John, did you type that up?
I genuinely think those lyrics I just freestyled are better than Ronnie Radke's. I genuinely do.
All right.
I think he can run for his money.
As we were saying, the Hold Steady are raising money for a new covers EP. And they're planning a new album in 2014. So the band has maintained a relatively low profile since 2010's Heaven Is Whenever. And they recently went to raise money for a covers EP on one of those Kickstarter sites that's not Kickstarter, Pledge Music, it's called. So they raised around 143% of their requested funding goal, so they're going to do it. The EP will precede the band's next album, which is again expected in 2014. Each of the 5 songs on the EP will be selected by one of the 5 members of the band. So, yeah, you can find a little bit of information about this and a video that they put to help promote the EP fundraising efforts on Punk News. But there you go. There's going to be more Hold Steady stuff next year. Do we have anything?
Nah, it's cool. I mean, if that's what people were into, I'll just be interested to see what they pick. Good for them, I say. That's all I have to say.
I will say I will not buy the album unless Ronnie Radke is on it with his own freestyle.
I will buy it if Ronnie Radke is on it, for sure.
All right, so...
Yeah, I mean, you know, why not? You know, give him the B-side. So all for it.
Should we wrap this up by talking about Bruce? I suppose we should. Springsteen has posted the title track for his next album. The song is called High Hopes. The record is also called High Hopes. It's out on January 14th. You can look at the thing on Punk News. It's a lyric video, just so that you all know that even if you are Bruce fucking Springsteen, you cannot escape the lyric video. So that's just soul crushing to me. He was overruled by someone higher up that was like, nah, kids want lyric videos, man. So there you go. Anyways, any thoughts on this? John, just give it a listen.
I did, you know, it's kind of classic Bruce. I guess it's got sort of a more percussive world music vibe slightly. I think Bruce people will like it. Non-Bruce, it's not going to win over anybody new.
Yeah, I mean, you got to stick to what works. So, if you got to keep on going, you can't change it up. So, yeah, that's about that.
All right. Well, I don't really have anything to say about it. Yeah. That's a show.
High hopes for high hopes.
You got to stick to what works. Don't be a jerk. If I keep rhyming like this, I'll eventually get on Pitchfork. John Gentile, fresh for 2013.
Bruce Springsteen, 2015, featuring Ronnie Radke.
Did you just rhyme
book it.
Work with Pitchfork?
My rhyme would be so tight, you can't even handle it. I'm spitting this raw, manhandling it.
John's got the turntables.
All rhyme orange to the word syringe or door hinge. Ain't nothing to me. I'm freestyle. B-I-G.
Bruce is proud.
What has happened to us? All right, that's about it. I don't think we have a song to end on. So
Adam, I actually have a great song to close out with.
Oh.
Earlier on we were talking about Beastie Boys' Fair Use, and about 5 or 6 years ago, the Beastie Boys actually released a whole bunch of a cappella tracks saying, remix some of our songs if you want to play them for your friends. You just can't use them for any commercial purposes. Well, I think our podcast is a non-commercial purpose, right?
We've made, if anything, negative dollars.
So then I've got an exclusive remix of a Beastie Boys song that we can use, which is fair use within their permission. How about that?
That's better than awkward silence that I was going to do. So go right ahead.
This is the exclusive Locust Collective remix of the Beastie Boys' Burr Stick'em, which was a B-side from To the Five Boroughs, but this version is significantly different.
Cool.
So let's kick it.
Fresh dress, cause I shop at Modell. Deep in Brooklyn, I bowed the L's. Used to ride the D to beat the morning bell. They put on Murrow out on Avenue L.
Yeah.
that about does it for the show tonight. Thank you guys for being on, Chris and John. Thank you to, you know, Sound Guy Nerman for gluing this whole thing together. Thanks to anyone that contributed music or that we just stole music from to put on the show. If you didn't like it, we're sorry. If you want to contact us about anything that you saw on the show, you can email us at podcast@punknews.org. And as we must say every week, the opinions that were expressed on the Punk News Podcast are those of the individuals that were on the Punk News Podcast and do not necessarily reflect that of the Punk News mothership. So there you go. We'll see you guys in 7 days.